You're listening to the Decoding Culture podcast. I'm John Curran, and I'm interested in the ways that everyday culture shapes who we are, how things work, like organizations. This podcast sets out to understand ways in which we can learn to unwrap the often unpredictable and complex nature of culture. So this episode is part two of my conversation with Professor Les Back. Les is a leading sociologist and thinker at Goldsmiths University in London. He's also written many books, and in part one, we discussed his book, The Art of Listening, and how having the ability to listen sociologically opens up new ways of getting closer to understanding society and the everyday culture. So part two develops this further, where Les and I discuss the need to walk and walk sociologically. To quote Les from the recording, to study society, you need to get your boots dirty and move. This is a powerful quote and is relevant not just to social sciences conducting ethnographic research, but also leaders and HR individuals in organizations. Sometimes when I coach or train leaders to get their boots dirty, there's a resistance. This is understandable. Forcing oneself to move through everyday cultural spaces that we think we know, like an office, and then push oneself to see different things and question, why are they different? This can be threatening to our embodied sense of rationality and expertise and all the things that frame us as being professional. We often don't want to be challenged. I often think of culture as multiple frames that appear to have little curation. They are never static. The frames change in size and form to accommodate uncertainty. By physically moving, walking, and listening sociologically allows you to see multiple frames. The more frames you identify and interpret, the richer your understanding of the cultural ecosystem that exists around you. We start our conversation on the roof of Warmington Tower at Goldsmiths University in southeast London, looking over the London skyscape. We first discuss the cultural meaning of cities, and cities for Les are a crossroads of movement of people, things, and culture. This is powerful and emphasizes the need to move to be able to understand. We then spend time observing everyday culture at a busy bus stop in London, understanding the micro rituals at play and the multiple stories in front of us that the rituals frame. If you're a social scientist, then part one and two will add to your ethnographic repertoire. If you are a leader or work in an organizational development or HR, these episodes will help you to begin to think about the importance of decoding culture. So this is part two of the podcast with Professor Les Back from Goldsmiths College, London University. And welcome back, Les. Where are we standing?
Well, John, we're listening to London from above. We're at the top of Warmington Tower on the beautiful roof terrace we have where the Department of Sociology is. A police siren is coming into the soundscape right on cue.
Yeah.
I love this vantage point. So we're standing literally on top of the sociology department doing sociology. I've always loved the sound of London from up here, the sound of the city from above. You can hear the sort of restless hum below with the sound of the birds above. We're kind of away from the city, but somehow we can both see it and hear it at a distance. You know, one of the things that we talked about in the previous podcast was, well, how do you actually conduct sociology? And my sort of slogan that sociology is a listener's art is one, but also a commitment that we both share to the ethnographic tradition is, well, you know, to study society, you have to get your shoes dirty, you have to get out, you have to move. And so I love to come here with students for them to see the city from above, but also to hear it. It's like a kind of aural panorama up here. And sometimes it's really unnerving. Now, the sound of the birds that listeners might be able to capture, we can hear, or the sound of children. It's about lunchtime now, so there's lots of groups of school children who are coming out of school and going getting their cheap takeaways from local takeaway places. Sometimes it can be unnerving, but also then you can sort of sense movement in the city, you know, the sound of the cars. Sometimes you hear the clatter of trains. You know, South London is cut through with these arteries of movement, the train tracks. We can see them here, but sometimes we can hear them too, the sound of rubber on tarmac of cars moving through the city and the hum of those below. It's a sense of the rhythm of movement, and cities are always crossroads of movement of both people, things, and of culture. So I love to bring students up here and just get them to see the city from a distance, but also to sense it differently.
I think there's something about being in a city, you're always told to also look up.
Yeah.
But now we literally are looking down.
Yeah.
And the view we have here, I think what I might do is actually take a video and I could put it up on Twitter and then share the link on the podcast details. But, you know, there's the London Eye, there's the Shard, there's St. Paul's. It's basically a panoramic view of London. And then if we go to...
There's a Millwall football ground there, John. You didn't see that.
That's your local football ground.
Is that for a reason that you look past that?
It's near next to the recycling. I see. So I'll leave it like that.
You mean like the refuse collecting place.
Exactly, there you go. So it's, but it is incredible, this idea of the kind of different vessels that a city has.
Yeah.
And it fits into our ethnographic mindset, which is, as again Gillian Tett talks about, the bird's eye view and the worm's eye view.
Exactly. The bird's eye view has its enchantments, you know. The view of the gods, as De Certo once put it, you know. And we do look up in cities. You know, you think about Manhattan, for example. We think of it through the signature of the cityscape, of the skyscrapers. But we often experience cities from ground level or the worm level, as she says so beautifully. You know, so we, in a way, getting away from the ground enables a certain kind of sense of the panorama.
Yeah.
And also, you know, I think it's both visual and sonic and aural, you know. We're somewhat at a distance.
Yeah.
And that affords a certain insight and understanding, but also the extreme proximity of moving down to ground level has another kind of opportunity, you know. So there are things that we can't hear and see from up here that you can see at ground level. Equally at ground level, there are things that you can't see from that sort of intense proximity, and getting away from it enables us to kind of see the broader panorama in a different way, you know. So it's, I believe that one view is better than another, but we need to move around. And that's partly our theme for today, isn't it?
That's a great point. And I'm going to make this, relevant to actually a lot of the listeners on the world of organisational culture, where to get an understanding of how our employees are experiencing work, we do a survey.
Yeah.
And although the survey can tell us stuff, it has its own stories.
Yeah.
But it doesn't incorporate the bird's eye and the worm's eye.
No, it doesn't.
And that's the big issue. Maybe I always feel when I'm doing work in organization, that the worm's eye part of it is where the fear lies as well.
Yes. Well, it's also where the containment can be, in the sense of being trapped, actually, can't it? You know, I think that's right. And, you know, as researchers of any kind or investigators of any kind, we often think, okay, in order to find out about something, we need to find a quiet place which we can talk to somebody one-to-one, or, you know. Well, actually, if you do move around, if you let the environment, whether it's in this organisation or in a street, or, you know, like we are today, a whole city, a global city like London, moving around, moving across scales, traversing the territory, enables us to think differently, I think, to have different kinds of conversations, but also to let the world, the social world and the physical world, into our conversation as an actor, as a stimulus, as a way, as one of the sort of narrators in the story.
Yeah. The other thing you're interested in, Les, is the sociology of walking.
Yeah.
And we've spoken the first part about listening. So walking, what is the sociology of walking?
Well, it's somewhat in the same spirit, John, as we were talking before. I do think in order to understand the social world, we need to get out, get our shoes dirty a bit. You know, we need to move around. We need to encounter. We need to engage. One of the things that I think is really interesting about walking as a practice, walking and talking, a bit like what we're going to do shortly, is it means something quite different to walk and talk when you're alongside someone as opposed to when you're in front of them and addressing them directly. You know, our reflex is to do interviews when we do research. You do interviews, and there's something about the interview method, that sort of across the table with a tape recorder between us, that can be haunted, you know. So when you think about where do interviews take place, where we hear them every day on the radio or on the TV, politicians being interviewed, but also there's the police interview, there's the immigration interview. And so for some groups who have been the subject of those kinds of investigations, a social science interview can sometimes bear the ghosts of that kind of intrusive listening. You know, mining someone for the absolute truth, you know, the truth and the whole truth and nothing but the truth of the criminal justice system. So, for example, if, you know, working with migrants or people who have spent time under the heel of those forms of intrusive listening, the conventional social science interview can be a very uncomfortable place, whereas walking alongside and walking through familiar places can have a very different feel, and that those places can be part of the conversation too. You know, calling out places that you spend time or have visited or have been meaningful in some way can produce a different kind of story of social life.
Okay, and so that's all about then very much being with someone,
yeah,
and walking and then talking. And that reflects with me a bit around the idea of when I'm doing coaching sometimes,
yeah,
and I'm taking people, or people decide to go for a walk,
yeah,
but actually using not the walk as time to reflect, but then also start using objects that we see along the way,
yeah,
as reference points,
yeah,
to,
yeah,
what you're talking about.
As prompts, you know. I mean, we're talking up here, you know, the sound of the police sirens was a prompt. When I was writing The Art of Listening, you know, after the London bombings, the soundscape of the city changed. The sound of the police siren became like a keynote sign, a sound of urban life. And you hear it an awful lot in this corner of London, which is subject to the police's investigations in all kinds of ways.
Yeah.
But, you know, it does become a feature, a prompt, an aspect of the conversation. And I think, you know, the idea of the interview itself, you know, the etymology of that term goes back to the Latin to travel with, travelling with, rather than, you know, inquiring into. And that sort of ancient sense of the interview being a travelling with someone in conversation, exchanging views, I think walking methods can allow that in an interesting way.
Yeah. And what about walking, or is this something you do in the sociology of walking by yourself?
I mean, well, you know, there's the ancient, and you'll know this already, you know, Charles Baudelaire, the romantic figure of the flaneur, you know, yeah, the dandy who wanders through the city and gets lost and discovers things. And yeah, there's something about that, and the philosopher Walter Benjamin writes a beautiful essay on the flaneur as a way of understanding, getting lost, actually. I mean, we can't really get lost anymore in the world of Google Maps in the way that we once might have done. But that sense of, and our mobile phones, of course, that sense of getting lost in the city or in any environment and discovering it anew goes right back to sort of modernist ideas around experimentation and sense and sensory experience. Now, not everybody can get lost, you know, and the experience of walking through the city can sometimes make us confront the ways in which the geometries of power, you know, enable some and impede others, you know. we were talking about this before in the previous edition, when, you know, that experience of street racism, one of the things that young black people told me all the time in the early 1980s was how much on the street they would be scrutinized. Or, you know, young black men would talk about, you know, walking through the street and being questioned, or the purse of a white woman standing at the bus will be clutched, and those sort of gendered and damaged encounters, actually, which are affected by the social dynamism of racism, really, the activity of it, its features can be that. But equally, you know, the experience of women, we're very mindful of it in recent times, you know, the sort of gendered forms of violence and power that can be enacted on the street too. So the street isn't an innocent place, it's a place that's divided, but in a way I've always thought the value of getting people out of the classroom and encountering and moving through the city, it's an opportunity to reckon with those things, to reason with them and reckon with them.
I think that's a really good point. It kind of, that idea of street, how different groups, we can be cheek by jowl, but we read a space and a place differently.
Yeah.
And that can be, but so much of that is about experience, but it's also about the artifacts.
Yeah.
And it's interesting when buildings or trees or park benches become,
yeah,
those cultural artifacts.
Yeah.
I kind of thought about this idea of walking through metaphor. So not walking as a metaphor, but actually you walk, the things around have that symbolic meaning.
Yeah, yeah. Because you're encountering the landscape as not a abstract thing, as a lived thing, a lived sort of environment through which we are, you know, bringing social life, we're animating it, we're putting it in motion.
Yeah.
And it's not that the park bench is walking, but we're walking through it, you know. And I love those sorts of everyday, ordinary aspects of the architecture of cities, for example. They're often full of extraordinary experiences and meaning that are kind of deposited within them.
Yeah.
You know, I can think of lots of examples of this, but, you know, one of the projects that I mentioned last time was a book called Migrant City, and one of the migrants who was who fled Afghanistan actually had his immigration claim turned down in 20 minutes in Croydon at Luna House, spent 3 years appealing that. He was living in this kind of suspended dead time, couldn't work because he was waiting for his claim to be reviewed. What did he do with that dead time? Well, he found a disused bench, sorry, a disused bed in the back garden of the flat that he was living with, and he basically collected all this dead wood and made, in that dead time, that time that he had, a bench that he then took out into the street that his elderly white neighbours would go and sit on, you know. And it was just a kind of extraordinary thing, you know. You think, well, actually, there was a kind of more convivial sense of London life that was literally being made out of the detritus and the cast-off rubbish. Yeah. And so, you know, he took us there to see the bench. You know, we went together. We encountered the space. We encountered this kind of very ordinary but quite beautiful gesture towards a different way of living.
Yeah.
And met some of the elderly white folk who heard this, you know, this refugee from Afghanistan had befriended, you know.
Yeah, no, I think that's... There's also, I mean, we see for years now, but the notion of placemaking and planning and architecture, it's about engagement with the local community,
yeah,
and running workshops, and there's a lot of interesting stuff going there.
Yeah.
But it is interesting about, how, you know, that kind of trying to design for a community, which sometimes I feel is almost impossible, because people mould things to their need and to their changing needs. So if you're building a building, it's static.
Mm.
And culture is definitely not static.
No, you know, and so getting out and about, getting involved in the flow and rhythm of life, on foot or in any way, really, but that sense of engagement, I think walking is a wonderful way to engage in this sense. It's a very, you know, it's a very ordinary practice. It's not something we can take for granted. I mean, I've done lots of walking research workshops, and I remember one year it was a student who came on it who had with a prosthetic limb, who had an artificial leg, and walking wasn't straightforward for that person. So walking through the city and encountering it was very different. And, you know, you think about what does it mean to encounter a city if you're reliant on a mobility scooter, or if you're pushing a pram, you know, as a young parent. All those things change our experience of moving. So in a way, those differences that make a difference are important for us to be attentive to and aware of as well.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, should we, you mentioned the first episode, the bus stop.
Yes.
Should we go?
Yeah. So we're up here in the sky, which is a very beautiful place to be, and the city, it's quite something, John, isn't it? It's quite something to see the city, you know, really from east to west. We're looking north and the River Thames is just down there in the Millennium Dome. And, you know, the financial district of Canary Wharf now, which is like London's Manhattan. You know, there were many years when there was just one solitary, like an obelisk. Canary Wharf Tower was one solitary tower, but now it does look a little bit like Manhattan. So the city seems kind of extraordinary up here, I think. But let's get down onto the ground.
On that point, though, just about the financial landscape, yeah. I can see in the distance one of the big towers has got JP Morgan.
Yes, indeed.
And then if we look down here, there's a building that says no banks, no borders.
Yes.
And there's something there, isn't it? I mean, they're about 5 miles apart, those two.
Well, they're probably not even 5 miles, John. So, you know, that's the thing that I've always loved about the city, you know. The city isn't one thing. The city is a crossroads. The city is a place where different visions of the world are struggled over. So, yeah, of course you have those citadels of global finance, JP Morgan, HSBC Tower. We can see them. They're huge monuments in steel and glass. And then we have scribbled in, you know, with a spray can graffiti, no banks, no borders, on the side of a house in a tiny little corner of southeast London that's really in the... It's so close, it's almost in the shadow of that. And in a way, that's the story of London, really, a place of you know, not only of global capital now, but also, you know, the capital of the British Empire, the River Thames, the jugular vein of empire, you know, the place where the rewards of and things that were stolen through the empire were literally unloaded. We can see the River Thames from here, but equally it's a place where a different vision of what Britain might be and the children of empire, well, how they remade a sense of the world and of modern life in the same place, in the same streets. You know, we mentioned John LaRose before, but also figures like C.L.R. James, the great Caribbean intellectual who lived in Brixton for a long time. You know, the extraordinary figure, Linton Kwesi Johnson, the dub poet. We can see where he studied sociology in the 1970s down there on Lewisham Way, at 40-something Lewisham Way. You know, so the city becomes a place where the vision of not only the present and the future is contested, at the same time where the past is interrogated too. So should we go downstairs?
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Up a tour.
We could just walk through the leaves or something.
It's a nice sound. I bet it sounds cool, doesn't it?
Yeah. Cool. Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
So here we are, John, on the ground level, just walking through the autumn leaves. I bet what's going to happen now that the city will play a trick on us and it won't sound as if we anticipate it.
It's going to be totally pure.
Pure and quiet, exactly. Oh, maybe not.
Yeah.
So we're just walking past the entrance of Goldsmiths College onto Lewisham Way. The record shop that I mentioned, Joe Gibbs' famous record shop, was just literally across the street there on Lewisham Way. But, you know, the proximity to London's kind of lifeblood and movement that you get from walking through the city. You just can just feel it, you know. Something about encountering these places, the conversations that we overhear, the chance meetings, the people getting on and off the buses. There you go, there's the 177 to Peckham. The world seems different from this point of view.
Yeah.
We have to encounter its rhythm. We have to submit to its rhythm sometimes, you know. A bit like waiting for the bus. The bus is going to come when it's going to come.
Yeah.
And so I think there's something about that that makes us think about inhabited life and the coexistence with others. I mean, I've spent so many hours, John, sitting on buses, scribbling down overheard conversations or things that are interesting or, you know, clues. The sound of people's voices, you know, I often say to people, you know, just go and sit on a London bus and just listen. Not necessarily to what people are saying, but the languages that they're speaking, how they speak to each other, the kind of, the choreography, if you like, the ballet of social life that you often see there. And sometimes it's funny and absurd and pretty, and sometimes it's not, you know, sometimes it's ugly and tough and violent.
Well, I think when I used to teach at Goldsmiths in the anthropology department, the methods course, I used to get the students to spend 1 week taking the bus, but only on the lower deck. And then the next week they had to go and do the top deck and then write a cultural comparison between the two different cultures of a bus.
Yeah.
And that was amazing. And there is something about it goes back to part one about listening and empathy. If we're observing on a ground level here, we should push ourselves. We should be thinking about what stories am I seeing, and then questioning yourself about why you're framing it in that way. So it could be a homeless person over there or someone, but you're trying to create the story of what that person, who that person is, and then question yourself about why you've come to that conclusion.
You know, the great, perhaps the most famous sociologist that's alive today is an American sociologist called Howard S. Becker. He wrote a fantastic book in the 1960s called The Outsiders, where he did a kind of analysis of marijuana smoking in the age of the counterculture. It was like, made sociology very cool. A jazz musician, an extraordinary man. He came and spent a week with us a few years ago. He's in his 90s now. And he was talking about an example of a student who had done this extraordinary ethnography of a car mechanic workshop. And I turned to Howie at one point in front of the audience of people that had gathered to listen to him and said, "Wow, that's really amazing, Howie. Who would have thought? It's so interesting." And Howie just turned back to me and said, "You know, everywhere is interesting.
Yeah.
Everywhere is interesting if we can tune our ears and our attentiveness to be able to render and admit that which is interesting in any given place. Everywhere is extraordinary."
Yeah.
It's just our capacity to recognise those qualities that are extraordinary in any given context.
And I think that that's where my fascination, especially of organisations, because it's actually something I try and do with organisations and with leaders, is try to say organisations are places you should be walking. You know, the old term, walking on the shop floor.
Yeah.
Right? You know, but there's so much importance about understanding what's going on and being able to listen as well as what we said, without it being a form of surveillance, but a form of empathy.
No.
You know, people in power should be doing this as a means of questioning themselves more to become better in what they're doing.
Well, you know, I'm sure those people listening to this podcast are saying, "Well, how does this relate to me?" Well, when you think about it, oftentimes, I think executives or people who are running organisations who are trying to do the very best for their organisation, they're operating within worlds that are kind of socially soundproofed. It might be the boardroom, it might be whatever kind of organisational structure there is to separate out spheres within that institution or organisation. Truth is, if you're operating within a place that is kind of socially soundproof, then you're limiting your understanding of the dynamics of the whole.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we need to move around, and that's why training these forms of attentiveness are useful across spheres of, you know, commerce, politics, policy. You know, I think being able to admit that, to be able to make the familiar strange, to re-enchant it, to reimagine it through that re-enchantment, I think those are incredibly important opportunities for anyone who wants to do better in their organisations or in the things that they're trying to achieve.
Yeah, and I've just noticed, my observation, and across, we've got a lot of eating places, but next to each other is a Turkish kebab shop, a Vietnamese food place. But it also made me think, well, that's part of the Southeast London urban life here. Yeah. What's interesting, though, if we went to a service station along the highway or the motorway, we'd still now see that variety. Or you go to a King's Cross station where millions have been put into it as a retail, and they're doing the same thing. And it's interesting how this, the idea of street becomes also a consumable good, right? It becomes that world of brand choice, where here it's about history.
It is, but it's also a place of display, you know.
Yeah.
Even those histories that are maybe ones that aren't so obvious, or the ones that are, you know, they have their secrets. Streets are fantastic in that regard, because on the one hand, they're very showy, they're places to display, but they're also places of that are puzzles, you know, which I've always thought is one of the things that's so rich about city life as a place to do sociology, is that it's both kind of spectacular and a total puzzle at the same time.
And also, it's just kind of, we're here at there are about three bus stops and lots of buses. It's and within about 20 meters from us is the Goldsmiths Library.
Yeah,
and then you can see the advertising on the bus stops. It's all Pepsi Cola and young people, but it's actually immediate communication to the students in a very subtle.
Yeah.
Everything's trying to talk to everyone. Everything here is trying to communicate, for the good or the worst, for profit, for, you know, society, I don't know. But it's just standing here then for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, we've created a sense of the ecosystem of this place.
Well, you know, I think one of the people who I've really been influenced by is a strange Italian political cultural figure called Antonio Gramsci, who was imprisoned by Mussolini, who spent most of his life in prison, actually, and wrote these extraordinary prison notebooks that have then been published after he died. And one of the Gramsci's great sort of slogans is, you know, the thing is that history, and we could say society, leaves within us all and within every place, and you've just called out some of these things, an infinite number of traces, an infinity of traces. But the trick that history and society plays on us all is it doesn't leave us with an inventory to recover them. We need to create our own inventory.
Yeah.
And I feel that the practice of leading an attentive life, the art of listening, is about creating that inventory.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, listen, my final question, and a question I ask all my guests.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you the anthropologist notebook, and you can take it anywhere, to any organisation or institution or place, and study that place for 12 months. Where are you going to take it and why?
Well, I love the idea of this, I must say. I'm going to try and cheat history a little bit, because there are many places I'd like to take it today. But I'd like to take the notebook back in time. We're just passing the anniversary of Engels' classic book, The Condition of the English Working Classes, in 1844. And in that book, Frederick Engels paints this incredible portrait of the River Thames at the high point of empire. He talks about coming up river and getting off the boat at London Bridge. So I'd like to take my notebook back into that world of maritime London at the high point of empire, really, when the River Thames really was the jugular vein of empire. I've always been completely in love with the river. You know, I think I'd like my ashes to be scattered in those waters when my time comes. But the thing that I find sad about the river today is that, in a way, that maritime past is more or less gone. The river is a place not of commerce anymore. It's a place of, you know, of developments and of riverside frontages for, you know, for luxury flats. But it was a working river. and I've always, you know, been fascinated by its Dockland past. But I would like to take my notebook onto one of those small little shuttle boats that would have had to shuttle across either side of the river and to the massive steamships that were being unloaded there, you know, unloading ivory and timber and leather from all over the world. Hey, and you. See what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, that's the street.
That's the street for you.
That's the street.
Yeah, that's where I'd like to take it.
Well, Les, listen, thank you so much for being a guest on the Decoding Culture podcast.
Oh, it's a total pleasure.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Decoding Culture podcast. I hope that you found part two of my chat with Professor Back interesting and now understand how important the sociological approach to listening and movement or walking is. If you're a social scientist or working in organizational culture, this became clear how helpful it is to be able to be reflective of your everyday surroundings and see the often silent stories that exist in front of us all the time. If you're interested in how anthropology adds value to organizational culture and change, I'll be running my 5-week training program for the fifth time, I think, in partnership with EPIC. So this is called Leveraging Organizational Culture for Impact. And keep an eye open on the EPIC website. I'll put all the details in the show notes. And please also do subscribe to the podcast feed and please give the podcast a rating on iTunes. To keep up to date with the interesting trends on culture, business and anthropology, you can also sign up to my Decoding Culture newsletter. The link will also be in the show notes. See you next time.